Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The major headline this week was, Will Israel Bomb Iran? Here are a few headlines just from the past few hours. The Telegraph, Benjamin Netanyahu raises fresh fears over Iran strike. MSNBC, clash with Iran could see use of huge new U.S. bomb. CNN International, Israel weighs risk benefits of Iran strike. And Wired, U.S. defense chief to Israel, we'd hit Iran harder than you. The major storyline was about last weekend's AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C. So many people, almost every speaker, talked about the possibility of a strike on Iran. So how should the media cover this and the messages the U.S. and Israel are sending? What questions should the media be asking about this issue? Today we're joined by Chris Tonzin. He's editor of the Middle East Report and executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And I should mention that a little later in the show, we'll be discussing media coverage of the rallies that took place in Sacramento. Thousands of students, faculty, and their supporters went to Sacramento to demand an end to budget cuts. So Chris, as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'd like to hand out a couple of kudos. The first would go to Bob Dreyfus, a veteran reporter for The Nation and other outlets, who has a good piece on The Nation's website today that addresses precisely the questions that you're talking about, the intersection between Israel, the U.S., and Iran on the nuclear issue. And the second piece is by Robert Malley, who's not a journalist, but is a former policymaker and now the head of the Middle East Division of the International Crisis Group, a very important think tank. And he has written a piece that's on the foreignpolicy.com website, which is about the same issues. And essentially what both of these articles argue is that most of the media coverage of the brouhaha at the AIPAC conference this week about Iran kind of got the story wrong. Most of the media coverage, at least in the major outlets, said that what emerged from this conference is that Israel, which had been rattling its saber very noisily toward Iran and hinting very broadly that it would launch its own airstrike on Iran's nuclear research facilities if the U.S. did not do so, was basically told to stand down by President Obama, who said, in effect, that the policies of sanctions and attempts at negotiations with Iran must be given time to work before a military option is weighed. And that is true, but it's not the whole story, and it may not even be the most important part of the story. As both Dreyfus and Malley pointed out in their pieces, President Obama basically inched the U.S. position closer to Israel's by saying more forthrightly than he had in the past that the U.S. would, in the end, weigh the option, at least, of a military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities if it believed that Iran was making some kind of progress toward having nuclear material that could be used to build a nuclear weapon. And so at the end of the day, I think as Rob Malley put it, the President Obama may have won the battle against the forces pushing for a war with Iran, but he may have lost the war, as it were.
Hmm. Okay, so based on the speeches you heard at AIPAC and the activity that went on there, you're an editor. What would your headline be? What would the main point of your article be?
I guess my headline would be both Israel and the United States ratchet up, in the historical perspective, an atmosphere of war talk that has been building since really December of last year. And, you know, this is not new, I'm sure, that your listeners are familiar with the previous rounds of war talk from both Israel and the United States and the Bush administration and the Obama administration with regard to Iran. And this round feels a lot more serious than those earlier rounds. I don't think it means that either Israel or the U.S. is going to launch an actual airstrike or more on Iran this year, certainly not before the U.S. presidential election. But in the long term, in the next couple of years, it is something that we should be very concerned about. There is a real possibility that scenario is drawing closer.
And I'd like to let listeners know that Chris Tonzing will be with us for about 15 or 20 minutes, so more minutes. So if you'd like to join in on this section about media coverage of the AIPAC conference and about the media's coverage of Israel, Iran, and the United States and nuclear weapons, we'd love to hear from you. This dominated headlines this week. What really stood out for you? Did you see analysis that really asked the right questions? The toll-free number is 866. And what are those questions? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. I was actually going to ask you, Chris, how serious you think these threats are, because Reuters ran a piece yesterday called Israel Asks U.S. for Arms That Could Aid Iran's Strike. Israel has asked the U.S. for bunker buster bombs and refueling planes that could improve its ability to attack Iran's underground nuclear sites. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a few years ago, the U.S. approved sale to Israel of so-called bunker buster bombs, which are essentially earth-penetrating weapons that can be used to collapse underground bunkers, and it's thought that many of Iran's most important nuclear research facilities are buried in some cases under mountains, and so one would need such advanced weaponry if one was going to attack them. Now, the United States has its own bunker buster weapons, which are actually even more powerful than those which have been approved for sale to Israel. And there was an article in the Washington Post last week to the effect that the new generation of bunker busters in the U.S.'s own arsenal would be capable, U.S. military officials believe, of attacking even the bunkers in Iran that are buried under the mountain. And so, you know, in terms of the overall picture that's being conveyed by the media, what I would say is that, you know, a lot of the objections that have been raised by former U.S. officials, by Israeli officials, former Israeli officials, by all kinds of voices across the political spectrum who are opposed to the idea of attacking Iran, a lot of those objections have been technical in nature. That is, they have said, essentially, an attack on Iran would only slow down the progress that Iran is presumed to be making toward building a nuclear weapon. They wouldn't stop the program entirely. You couldn't knock out the program, certainly not with a single strike. You would need a wave of strikes, and even that might not do the job. And so the by introducing this element of especially the U.S. bunker buster, which can supposedly even go through several hundred feet of rock in the case of that mountain, is essentially to say that these technical objections are ultimately not to be listened to, that ultimately the decision whether or not to attack Iran is a political one, not a purely military one. So in that way, it's also reminiscent of some of the debates that went on in the advance of the Iraq War, where similar objections were raised.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line on this, so let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Hi. You know, first thing out, we would wish that we would hear more discussion of this along the lines of the part of the initiative that's being proposed that's completely unprecedented, as far as we know, which is what happens when you launch an assault with high-powered explosives against an operating nuclear facility, whether it's an enrichment facility or some other kind of laboratory, or whether it's medical materiel, or whether it's a nuclear power reactor. When you breach the containment of a reactor or enrichment facility and release radioactive material into the environment, where does it go? And what happens to your allies who are downwind from that? Well, how can we be discussing this kind of an assault on the entire planet?
Yeah, well, look at Fukushima. Well, thank you for calling in. Let's take a few more calls, and then we'll get a response. Let's go to Steve in San Francisco. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me on. I have a few questions, actually, for the gentleman. I'd like to know, first of all, why is it that nothing is ever discussed about the fact that the state of Israel has nuclear weapons, even though the United States government has a law that states that anybody who's not part of the International Atomic Energy Agreement should not be getting American aid at all for having nuclear weapons of any kind, yet Israel seems never to be discussed. The other question I have is, how can Israel send an air force across the country of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and I don't know who else, without getting permission on crossing their airspace, without them declaring war on those countries as well?
Right.
And, you know, considering that we as the United States of America, because that's the only country I really care about, gets 3% of its energy needs from the Middle East, what the heck are we doing? I mean, the other 97%, I would think those countries would have much more of an interest in making sure, if indeed Iran was a threat, that they would want to be taking further action rather than us. I'm getting a little bit worried about the fact that, you know, we're going to alienate ourselves more from the moderate Muslim countries and the people that think that there's a dual standard here. Israel can do whatever it wants, and other countries don't have a right to develop their own technologies. Thank you.
Well, all right, thank you. And let's take a few more calls, and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Wendy in Berkeley. Hi, Wendy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. First of all, I was wanting to say that I can't imagine, with the level of alarm that's being expressed, that it would take several years for us to find out what's gonna come. And I also wanted to ask, you know, why is AIPAC hosting this conversation, and do you think that's appropriate? I actually find it really upsetting.
What upsets you about it?
I think AIPAC has a role, in U.S.-Israel relations, but as a person who supports peace and who's against war, all around, it justifies not just the, anti-Israel, protest, but the peace activists and in protesting AIPAC.
Mm. Well, excuse me, there was Occupy AIPAC, and there were protests in front of the conference. It didn't get that much attention, but there was a lot of activity on Twitter about it. Thanks for calling, Wendy. And let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. John Carroll has a wonderful article in Datebook, Today's Chronicle, The Drumbeats of War, again is the title. And at the bottom he says, we should not let a foreign power control our foreign policy, particularly if we're talking about war. And, for me, this is the first time that Obama has ever put the brakes on it. And, he never talks about Gaza and what happened there. Mm-hmm. And so I think he finally stood up. And I like his moderate, let's play all the other cards first. Thank you.
Well, all right, thank you. So, Chris, there's so much interest in this. We still have so many more calls. A lot of questions about the consequences. And I guess what's amazing to me is that we can talk about bombing another country with so much ease at this point. Have you seen much coverage about what the consequences of bombing these facilities would actually be?
Well, no. And I thought that the gentleman's point was extremely well taken. Most of the coverage of what the fallout, no pun intended, would be of a strike on Iran tends to talk about how Iran would counterattack, what price Israel would pay, what price the United States, especially its bases in the region, would pay, whether Iran would attack U.S. allies in the Persian Gulf, and so on. There is very little attention given to what the impact of strikes would be on the Iranian civilian population. And a crucial question in that regard is what effect the release of nuclear material into the atmosphere would have, not just on Iranians, but as the gentleman said, neighboring countries where the material might be carried by the wind. And that's an extremely serious question, and it is appalling that this discussion is taking place without some debate, at least,
right,
of that question. Now, there were a lot of excellent questions, and I won't be able to cover all of them, I'm afraid. Briefly to Steve, Israel, unfortunately, is usually exempted from the discussion of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty because it is not a signatory to the treaty. And so the fact that it has a large nuclear arsenal of its own usually kind of flies under the radar screen for that reason. More egregious example with regard to the U.S. position actually is India, which developed a nuclear weapon even though it was signatory to the treaty and was under some U.S. sanctions until 9/11 made all that go away. Same with Pakistan. So there is a great deal of hypocrisy in the U.S. position toward nuclear diplomacy viewed worldwide. And then, of course, the biggest hypocrisy of all is the fact that the U.S. presumes to be global policeman of this issue when it, of course, has the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, is the only country to have ever actually used a nuclear weapon. With regard to the question of airspace that Steve also raised, that's also an important issue. It is one of the reasons why Israel would like the U.S. to mount the strike if it happens, because Israel would have to fly over nominally hostile airspace to do it. The U.S. has its assets at sea and so on from aircraft carriers and could do it that way. But paradoxically, actually, this issue of airspace is now viewed as less of an impediment to an Israeli strike than it was a year ago. Why? Because the U.S. is no longer occupying Iraq. And the idea was that if Israel were to mount its own strike when the U.S. was occupying Iraq, that it would be such an embarrassment to the U.S. because obviously the U.S. would detect the Israeli planes flying overhead and so on. And now that the U.S. is not there and that Iraq itself does not have the same capabilities, of course, that the U.S. occupying forces did, this is viewed as less of an impediment, ironically. And finally, I think I skipped over something important, but finally, this question of why AIPAC and why this conversation was held at this venue, and that's also a very important question. The whole issue of Israel and the pro-Israel lobby and its relation to U.S. Middle East policy is a very complicated one. The bottom line is that no foreign country makes U.S. Middle East policy. The U.S. makes U.S. Middle East policy. Israel and the pro-Israel lobby have a great deal of influence, particularly with regard to the Palestinians, and they have a considerable amount of influence when it comes to other issues. But there has been a lot of media attention to the role of Israel and the pro-Israel lobby in this case, and actually, what's going undiscussed in this case, in the case of Iran, is what is the U.S. interest in making sure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon if, in fact, it is doing that, and that relates, of course, to Persian Gulf oil, it's actually more often the case in our media that the U.S.'s own interests, as they have been pursued historically, are less talked about and less covered than the predilections of various foreign powers, including Israel.
The Economist magazine covered this, and the article states, quote, "American-Israeli relationship now resembles the sort of crazy codependency one sometimes finds in doomed marriages, where the more stubborn and unstable partner drags the other into increasingly delusional and dangerous projects whose disastrous results seem only to legitimize their paranoid outlook." What are your thoughts on that?
that there is a lot to agree with there. I think both with regard to this Iran issue, both Israel and the U.S., the U.S. to a lesser degree, but still the U.S. as well, have both predicated their diplomacy upon the concept that the leadership in Iran needs to believe that both Israel and the U.S. are, in a sense, crazy, that they would mount such an attack, knowing the consequences, not just for the possibility of civilian casualties, but also for the possibility of blowback that would kill Israeli civilians, that potentially would affect Americans as well. That knowing of the consequences for global oil markets, knowing of the consequences for the strategic postures of the U.S. and Israel and its other Arab allies in the region, knowing of all these things, that they would still do it, right? It's such an irresponsible way to pursue a discussion on such an important strategic matter. And it's also predicated on the notion that the Iranian leadership only understands the language of force and threat and belligerence. And that is, a notion that is infused with no small amount of racism and no small amount of Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. But it is also belied, by a long history of international relations, period. Not just in the behavior of Iran, but also in the whole history of the Cold War, for example. In the Cold War, we had two rival superpowers, both armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, and both powers understood very well that you couldn't have wild flights of rhetoric and threats of attack and so on, that was extremely dangerous.
And what about just the overall facts behind whether Iran is pursuing a weapon? Because American intelligence agencies say there's no evidence. Recent assessments by American agencies have reaffirmed findings in 2007 and 2010, concluding that Iran has abandoned the program. But the New York Times mentioned it in one of their stories last week, but this isn't getting that much attention. And then this morning on NPR, they interviewed Paul Pillar about his Washington Monthly article called "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." He teaches security at Georgetown. So what about this important question?
That's absolutely a very important question. And the fact is that nobody outside the top leadership in the Islamic Republic of Iran knows whether Iran does in fact have the intention to build a nuclear weapon. All that is known is that Iran now has a small amount of low-enriched uranium, which could be further enriched to make the kind of uranium that you need to have a nuclear bomb. That's all that is known. Nobody knows anything more than that. Everything else is speculation, accusations, unfounded talk. The question about the Iranian nuclear program is not a question of what we know or what we don't know. It's a question of what intentions we attribute to the Iranian leadership. It is in the interest of Israel, in the interest of the Saudis and Iran's other enemies in the region, and in the interest of the hawkish elements in American domestic politics to attribute always the worst of intentions to Iran. And that sort of projection of the worst of intentions is what is unfortunately driving and shaping the national debate in the country about this issue.
And but we will definitely
not known.
We'll definitely continue this conversation. Chris Tonzin is editor of the Middle East Report and executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. Thanks so much for joining us, Chris.
Thank you, Rose.
And coming up after the break, we will talk about media coverage of the arrest that happened in Sacramento, where students are demanding an end to budget cuts. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. Every week, 10,000 listeners all over the Bay Area tune in to KALW, but not at 91.7, but via our online streams at kalw.org. So if you travel outside the Bay Area, or if there are times when you encounter the limits of our signal, the online stream is a great way to stay connected. And if you have a smartphone, you can listen on your iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of kalw.org, and you'll see all the options. And thanks for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we'll have a conversation with our very own Marilyn Pittman about her one-woman show, It's All the Rage. The subtitle, Heartbreaking and Hilarious. Marilyn shares the story of the day her father shot and killed her mother and then killed himself. I saw the one-woman show last night at The Marsh in San Francisco. It's incredible. And you can find more information about this at The Marsh website. Again, the show play is called It's All the Rage, and Marilyn Pittman will be joining us on Monday. We'll talk about art and helping recovery and healing. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're going to switch gears a bit here and talk about media coverage of what happened on Monday, where over 5,000 students, faculty, and their supporters gathered in Sacramento. They actually, a lot of them actually walked over the course of 3 days. They ended up in Sacramento on Monday to demand an end to budget cuts and an end to tuition hikes and everything else that students and teachers are facing right now. 72 students were arrested. And joining us to talk about this is Matt Krupnik. He's higher education reporter with the Bay Area News Group. That includes the Contra Costa Times, the Oakland Tribune, and the San Jose Mercury News. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Spencer Mills. He's a citizen journalist covering the Occupy movements. Hi, Spencer. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, let's start off with you. You had a really great piece that kind of summarized all of this. It's called Believe It, Harvard is Cheaper. And it talks about the fact that going to Harvard or Yale is now cheaper than attending a UC school.
Right. Well, and that's for that's not for everybody. You know, it's
right.
First of all, you have to get into those schools. Second of all, it's if you make up to a certain income level, then yeah, there are some real bargains to be had at the top flight private schools.
So a family making $130,000 would pay $25,900, while wealthier families pay $57,000.
Was that the Stanford number?
That was the Stanford number.
Right. Yeah. And then it's, if you take the same family and you put them at Harvard, they'd pay, I think, $17,000. And, at Cal State, it comes out to about $24,000.
Mm. Well, what's amazing about your piece is it got so much attention. I think, obviously, it was because of the headline, Believe It, Harvard is Cheaper. And I saw it tweeted all over the place. And
right.
It really drives home the point of what students are facing right now.
Right. I think part of it, a big part of it, and the reason it interested me was because, this is California. We are sort of the model for affordable higher education at public universities. And so to see that sort of changing and to see schools that were always out of reach for a lot of people suddenly becoming more affordable than Cal State campuses is a real sort of change for our philosophy here in the state.
What reaction have you received from this piece so far? Senator Leland Yee, Democrat of San Francisco, said, quote, "It's a little embarrassing that Harvard is cheaper than the California State University. When you price out so many students, it's devastating to the future of the state. Our sons and daughters won't be here to solve the state's problems."
Right, yeah. I know some of the lawmakers were pretty stunned to learn this. They didn't realize it had quite gotten to that point. I know some people have made the point, if you live at home, which a lot of Cal State students do, then it definitely lowers the cost because these net prices I was talking about include room and board and other expenses. So, there's that. I mean, if you take out the cost of a dorm and a meal plan, that really does lower the cost. But, if you're talking about a first-time freshman, the numbers, the graduation numbers are much higher for students who live on campus. And so I think it's important to note that the prices are much higher for those students, too.
And Spencer, you were in Sacramento on Monday. Set the scene for us. What were people talking about? And did you see many other reporters there interviewing students and faculty?
Well, there was definitely a lot of media there. Everybody met up at a park about, I'd say, 10 blocks from the Capitol. And you know, I'd estimate there were over 10,000 students there from all over the state, CSU students, Cal students, community college students. I mean, it really ran the spectrum of kids. And it was, you know, I mean, it was major. Kids were out basically really frustrated. A lot of the kids from CSU that I talked to had their tuition had more than doubled since they first started in school.
Right.
Cost of living is going up. All costs are basically rising together. And it's just making it incredibly hard for kids to avoid going to college. I talked to one kid who basically had all the classes that he needed to graduate canceled from CSU. And as a result, he wasn't going to be able to graduate for another year.
Wow.
on top of what he had already had to do.
So tuition and fees at the UC's 10 campuses are up a whopping 21% this year, according to the College Board. And according to UC Davis's own numbers, if you live on campus, you're going to spend about $32,000 a year.
Right. Yeah.
It's becoming pretty appalling. I think when my brother first attended UC San Diego back in, 1998, I think he was paying somewhere around $7,000 to $8,000 in tuition each year. Now kids are paying anywhere from $12,000 to $14,000 at UC's. And, you know, I mean, it's just there's no real end in sight. And you have all these different rate swap deals going on at the community colleges and elsewhere that are making it really difficult for universities to, you know, keep a reasonable tuition.
And Matt, this is one of the issues you highlight in your reporting, that it's taking much longer for students to graduate because they can't get their classes.
Right, and that's what really adds to the cost, you know, because if you're paying $24,000 a year for tuition and other costs, you know, that adds up. That fifth and sixth year really start to cost a lot more than it would cost to go to a private school where you graduate in 4 years, where you can get the classes you need and get the attention you need to get through your classes in 4 years.
So the other element of this that didn't really get much attention is the solutions, because so many of the students and the faculty who were there are trying to raise awareness about the millionaires tax of 2012. This is a ballot initiative that would require Californians who earn $1 million or more to pay an extra 3% in state income tax, and those who earn $2 million or more would pay an extra 5%. The California Federation of Teachers say these taxes would raise about $6 billion a year, and this would be distributed not only to education, but senior, child, and disabled services, things like fire services and roads and bridges. And this is going to be on the ballot in November. Matt, I noticed that the solutions that the students were talking about were mostly missing from a lot of the media coverage.
Yeah, you know, and maybe part of that is because, you know, I've been covering higher education for almost 8 years now, and it seems like there are always these solutions out there, and they rarely come to fruition. I can't say what's going to happen in November, but I just know that with the oil severance taxes that have been proposed over the last few years, that those keep failing. And, you know, there are all these taxes and other measures that are meant to increase education funding and stabilize it, and they never seem to come to fruition. So it's, I think that may be part of, maybe it's sort of solution fatigue among reporters.
Well, we did want to give kudos to Dan Walter of the Sacramento Bee, because he made a great observation in one of his recent pieces. He says the Democratic leader of the California State Senate, Daryl Steinberg, who spoke at the rally, decried what he called Republican obstructionism, but he did not mention that he opposes the millionaire's tax at the same time. So he was speaking to these students who are trying to gain support for this tax, and yet he doesn't support it and didn't mention it. So what role is it for reporters to really focus on the politicians' records and find out where they stand on these issues?
Well, I think that that's important, but you know, I think now when we're talking about a ballot measure, it seems like it's up to the people to decide, and you know, maybe that's the way it should be, or you know, it's hard to really see how the politicians could do much to affect it now that it's going to be on the ballot. But you know, I know that in the past, that's been a real problem, getting widespread support for any of these solutions. You know, the Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed some bills that would have provided more money for higher education. So we'll see what happens this time.
Spencer, what do you think about that element of the coverage, about the solutions and where politicians stand on these various measures?
Well, I mean, as far as the rally in Sacramento is concerned, you had, you know, two large names basically come out and talk. You had Gavin Newsom and you had Van Jones. I talked with Van Jones, and basically he's all for this, and he's constantly, you know, pushing it. But then you talk to somebody like Gavin Newsom, and I say, you know, what is your message to these students? How do you intend on fixing this? And he says, you know, I don't know. We have a lot of work ahead of us, and basically we heard you, but now we need to solve the problem. And I don't really hear any specifics. You know, you talk to Van Jones, he definitely pushes the millionaire's tax. You talk to a politician, and, well, they need to talk. And it's kind of frustrating because, you know, I mean, we've had this issue now coming, you know, and continuing to get worse and worse for over a decade. And it seems like it's just they're running us in circles as a state, and the students of the state, it seems like they're running folks in circles. So it's frustrating. I wish that the reporting body that was there, the gaggle of reporters that were there, would have, you know, asked more tough questions and put more pressure on for actual real solutions from these politicians. Unfortunately, that didn't seem to be the case.
That is Spencer Mills. He's a citizen journalist who's been covering the Occupy movements. We're also joined by Matt Krupnik, higher education reporter with the Bay Area News Group, which includes the Contra Costa Times, the Oakland Tribune, and the San Jose Mercury News. And we're talking about the rally that took place on Monday in Sacramento. A number of students actually walked to Sacramento from different parts of the state, and over 5,000 people showed up. They demanded an end to the budget cuts. They also came with a list of very clear-cut demands and solutions to this problem. So what did you make of the coverage? 72 people were arrested. Did you see it covered? What questions do you think reporters should be asking? How should this very important issue be covered in the media? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if there was another story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So we took a look at some coverage of this, and the AP article was called Occupy Education. And they reported that despite participation from outside groups, including the Occupy movement, protesters and supporters of the millionaire's tax, student organizers tried to keep the focus on education cuts. And then the San Francisco Chronicle said, unlike the basic no-cuts message brought to the Capitol every March, education's 99% have a specific agenda this year. They want two measures to qualify for the statewide ballot in November, the millionaire's tax and Prop 1522, an oil extraction tax. And students may noisily protest, says the piece, but they don't contribute money to politicians' campaigns, and their voting levels are notoriously low. The budget is a zero-sum game, and higher education plays a weak hand. Matt Krupnik, interesting to look at how the AP and the Chronicle, what angles they took.
Yeah, you know, I think that both make valid points and important points. I mean, it's good that the Chronicle pointed out the sort of apathy among students, because I know, you know, even though you get 5,000 people at this event on Monday, you know, when you talk to the students, they don't understand the issues. They, even the ones out there protesting, just don't understand, and they don't vote, and they don't know how to solve the problems. They don't have ideas on how to solve the problems that would actually work. And so, you know, I know that can be a little frustrating for people, and yeah, you know, I think that those are both valid points.
So based on the interviews you did with students, you feel like they don't understand what's going on and they don't know what solutions there are?
Yeah, that's generally what I find to be the case. They're angry and they have valid reasons to be upset, and they know what's happening to them. And so they realize what those problems are, but they don't realize how that translates to a budget solution. I mean, I think actually I will say that it's improved the last few months. I think that more people are informed, but I think that there's a widespread lack of knowledge about how the budget process works and, you know, basically who's at fault. I think they tend to blame the university for raising tuition, and there are some reasons perhaps that they could do that, but I think that really the blame mostly is elsewhere.
What about you, Spencer? What sort of read did you get from the students you interviewed?
Well, so students, I mean, I would agree. I mean, the budgetary process is very complicated, and I would say that the students, you know, very much don't really understand, in most cases, the details. What students do understand is how it impacts them on a semester basis, on a yearly basis, and how it's impacting their ability to graduate, to get the classes they want. I mean, so I feel like one side of the coin is understood by students, how it affects them in particularly because it affects their pocketbook. But as far as solutions and how the budget works and how to fix it, I do feel like there's a lot of education that's needed. And what a lot of times happens is, you know, politicians will understand the students don't understand. And so they'll come out and they'll basically give them some taglines like the millionaire tax cut or something else and try to placate them and move them forward. Or redirect their anger towards like Republicans or what else, rather than actually proposing real solutions and trying to get at the nuts and bolts of the issues.
Hmm. Well, let's go to callers on this. Let's hear from Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show. Hi, Peter. Sorry about that. Let's try William in Santa Cruz. Hi, William. Welcome to the show. Hello, William.
Hi, it's Peter.
Oh, hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Briefly, it's apt that you bring this up because I was listening to the show this morning and I was thinking, you know, I've been involved with all kinds of political movements here and Occupy in San Francisco. One of the things that's always frustrated me is that there's lots of talks of different kinds of actions and proposals, but when it comes to voting and voter registration, there seems to be not that much interest, but it is clearly obvious that the only way to affect change is getting out the vote. You know, this millionaire's tax is a great idea, but if young people aren't being registered to vote, then they're missing out. And I don't understand why there seems to be an anathema approach to voter registrations in various political and social movements that have happened recently. And I find it very troubling that there's a lot of talk of, you know, occupying banks and foreclosed homes. That's great, but are these people voting?
Hmm.
I'll take my question off.
Well, you know, we've had so many shows about that. I mean, what I hear, and I'm sure, Spencer, you can tell us many stories about people who are so dissatisfied with the process. And he's right. You hardly hear people talk about voting. In fact, there's a lot of talk about not voting at a lot of these actions. Spencer?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, especially within those individuals associated with the Occupy movement, there's kind of like there's two sides of the coin, two types of protesters. There's those that believe in reform and believe that you can fix the system from within, and then there's others that simply don't believe it at all and don't believe in voting and don't believe that it's going to really affect change. I mean, and what a lot of them will point to is Barack Obama and their disappointments with this politician that they believed in so much, you know, initially, and now they look at his negatives and his faults and things that he might not have accomplished that he said he would accomplish, and they say, see, you know, that's why I'm not voting. That's why I don't want to vote. So it's very much, you know, there's very much an inner battle amongst the Occupy movement that was there, amongst student protesters. I think, you know, you deal with the same thing folks have been dealing with for decades, and that's just apathy and lack of knowledge amongst youth. And hopefully, you know, I always say this, but hopefully that'll change. It doesn't seem to sometimes, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
Matt, you've been covering this issue for a long time. Is this something that you've explored?
It's something I've written about here and there. It doesn't really seem to change. You know, in 2008, you know, before or when Obama was elected, there was a big surge in youth voting, but, generally, you know, when there is a surge in voting, it tends to fall again among young people. And so I think that that's probably what we're facing this year again is a lack of youth at the polls in November. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that really tends to affect something like the millionaire's tax that would help education. It's definitely troubling, I think, for supporters of that.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Peter. And this is a really important angle that we'll definitely be covering and following in the coming months. Let's try William in Santa Cruz. Hi, William.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a quick comment and a question. I'm a signature gatherer. I'm gathering signatures for the millionaire's tax. Mm. And I know it's really impossible to predict whether an initiative will pass, but people are signing this petition very easily. I'm getting signatures for this really easily. I mean, there are people who won't sign it, obviously, but it is a very popular initiative. And my sense is that people are kind of fed up with the anti-tax hysteria that has been ginned up by conservative forces in our country, and there is a chance it could pass. My question is about, in terms of the fee hikes, is with the UC Regents, what role do they play? I know there's Richard Blum, the husband of Senator Feinstein, and his industry is private colleges, and he's on the UC Regents, and he's voting for fee increases, and I think that it's personally motivated in terms of his business wanting UC fees to be high so that his business enterprise with the private colleges, their fees will fit in under the UC fees. So what is the role of the UC Regents in the fee hikes?
Thank you. We did a show about the UC Regents about a month or so ago. And Matt Krupnik, what about the role the UC Regents play in this and how the media are covering this angle?
Well, I've been to a lot of UC Board of Regents meetings over the year, and I think the Regents are very much misunderstood by the public, and you know that's partly their fault. They're a pretty, it's a little hard to get access to them. You can't just go and talk to them generally. It's hard to get into meetings because CDN is limited. So I think that that's part of it. But I think the other part is that Regents really don't have that much power individually. I mean, they vote as a board. It's a large board, and I think that people like Richard Blum. I've seen no evidence that he's got an agenda when he goes in there. But I think that people should be asking more questions about the Regents, and I think that reporters should be exploring that more because they do, these are very rich, powerful people for the most part. And, there needs to be some transparency there.
Spencer Mills, what are your thoughts on the Regents and coverage of the Regents?
Well, I think it's clearly been lacking. I definitely think it's clearly been lacking. And I think there's been on all sides, I mean, the Regents included, I think there's just been a lack of willingness to try and investigate alternative options, for kids and for their students. I mean, the Regents themselves are a very difficult issue. Like when Cal went and protested the Regents meeting, it was mainly a direct result of the violence faced by UCPD on their campus. I mean, it was very much a result of pushback they felt from the authorities rather than actual policies or things pushed by the Regents. I mean, of course, tuition hikes and everything else played a part in it as well. But, had UCPD not come in and basically assaulted students, I don't know if it would have come to, mass protests at the Regents meetings and whatnot. So I think there's a large misunderstanding about what they actually do, how they're capable, how they do it and what they're trying to push. And I think, when students do protest the Regents or have protested the Regents, it's been for reasons other than, say, Regent decisions. It's been as a result of protest violence and things like that.
Can I add something?
Sure, Matt.
In all of the dozens or more of Regents meetings I've attended over the last 8 years, I can't remember one where there wasn't some sort of protest. I mean, this is just a sort of a routine thing. The thing that I've noticed is that, you have students and union members who come and they speak at public comment before the meeting, and they protest, and then they walk out, and they're not there for the actual decision. So it's impossible to know how the Regents vote and what sort of decisions they make if you're not going to stay and, listen to how business is done. So,
and they're able to stay if they want to?
They are, yeah. They could stay, but they choose not to. They walk out after public comment. It happens every single time. And so I think if you want to know how the university works, then stick around.
Do you ever ask them why they're leaving and not sticking around?
Yeah, they rarely have much of an answer. I mean, some of them, it's understandable because they have school or work to
right.
get to. But in other cases, they don't have a good answer.
So we've got 2 minutes left, and I just want to ask you both quickly about what we should expect from coverage of these propositions, because The Chronicle had a piece recently about the conflict between Governor Jerry Brown's proposition, which is a sales tax, and the millionaire's tax. And there's sort of behind the scenes infighting. People want Jerry Brown to change his proposition. He wants the students to say we're no longer supporting the millionaire's tax because he says that would be detrimental to the state. What are your thoughts on this, Matt? I'm assuming this is probably going to really anger the public because there's going to be a lot of fighting over the next few months.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting few months, and we'll have to see where people fall on these propositions because I think that there's going to be a lot of sort of division among parties that have traditionally been allies on things like this. So we'll see how the students fall and how the unions fall, and it'll be interesting to see.
And while the students suffer, a lot of money is going to be funneled into these tax proposition campaigns.
Right, exactly. And it would be interesting to see, what people think about that money being funneled there rather than to the universities, for instance.
And Spencer, your final thoughts on how this will play out and where should the media really focus in the coming months on these important propositions?
Well, I mean, first of all, the reason why there's this fight going on right now amongst normal allies is because of what we've seen over the last 6 months. With a changing of the dialogue nationwide, there's this 99 versus 1%, this tax the rich mentality and mantra that's come out of Occupy Wall Street and whatnot. And I think people the media is always gonna focus on the most raucous and salacious things that will get them the ratings they want. That's what I anticipate. I mean, I don't think the wheel isn't broken. I don't think that they're gonna try and fix it as far as how their coverage goes. I mean, it is broken, but they don't see it that way. So I anticipate much of the same.
All right. Well, we'll continue highlighting the good stuff, and we will continue following the money. Thank you so much, Spencer Mills, citizen journalist covering the Occupy movement, and Matt Krupnik, higher education reporter with the Bay Area News Group, including the Contra Costa Times and the Oakland Tribune. Thanks for joining us. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. How do you cope with tragedy and loss? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Marilyn Pittman about her one-woman show, It's All the Rage. Heartbreaking and hilarious is how her show is subtitled. She shares the story of the day her father shot and killed her mother and then killed himself. How does art help recovery and healing? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What resources are available for people who've experienced tragedy in their families? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, former President Jimmy Carter shares his thoughts on today's current events and talks about his new book, The New International Version, Lessons from Life Bible. Attorney Connie Rice weighs in on the so-called war on women. And gospel artist B.B. Winans discusses his new project, a CD called America, America. On the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show coming up at noon here on KALW San Francisco. And that's followed, of course, at 1 o'clock by Smiley and West with Tavis Smiley and Cornell West. It's 11 o'clock. We take you next to the BBC World Service for World Have Your Say on your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco. The time is 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGovern. Welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say. A failed hostage rescue in Nigeria.
I think everyone needs to remember that these things move extremely quickly and that we try to provide information in very quick time as well.
Chris McManus and Franco Lamolinara, held hostage in Nigeria, died during an attempt to rescue them yesterday. A heated debate is taking place about the way the operation was handled by British and Nigerian forces. The Italian president called the UK's decision to go in without informing them inexplicable. But the UK Prime Minister said there was a small window of opportunity and they had to act immediately. Well, you're debating what's acceptable when it comes to situations like these. And we'll have guests from Nigeria, Britain and Italy to speak with you. We do hope you'll tweet us. Use the hashtag WHYS.